I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with returned guest, IDF Sergeant Major Chaim Maelstrom. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. Chaim, your camera turned off. Hopefully you could get that back on.
Yeah, no, you can see me now.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. YouTube glitches are always fun. Anyway,
yeah.
So there's so much media attention on the war in Gaza and almost no context or reminders of how this war on Hamas started in the first place. It was October 7th, 2023, when the terrorists and civilians of Gaza flooded Israel and committed the most unmentionable, unfathomable, and inhuman atrocities to occur in the Western world since the Holocaust. Out of that day came the most devastating of tragedies, but also the most powerful, incredible, selfless, and inspiring heroes. Today, IDF Sergeant Major Chaim Maelstrom returns to the Yoga of War podcast to share some of the stories of these extraordinary Israelis who stepped up and went far beyond the call of duty to save lives and protect a nation. They deserve our utmost respect and appreciation and must never be forgotten. Chaim Maelstrom is the chairman of the board of the Aliyah Return Center and the host of the Real Israel podcast. A faithful Jew, Chaim dedicates all aspects of his life to helping the Jewish state and the Jewish people to thrive, and his dedication knows no bounds. While in the IDF, he served in the elite combat engineering corps, and now as a sergeant major in the reserves, he continues to serve with passionate and unrivaled dedication. His leadership has drawn global recognition, hosting dignitaries like the U.S. Vice President, and meeting with world leaders to build bridges between Jews and Christians. Chaim, it's the third time having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us again. I know you literally just got back from Gaza. Our focus today, as mentioned, is the heroes of 10/7 and the war thereafter. But first, can you give us a brief update on the war in Gaza?
It's an honor to be back here with you. It's a great honor to speak truth together and to have those freedoms, which aren't free, but they are the freedoms that we enjoy still in America and Israel in the West. I know there's a clash right now, a desire to plunge the world into an anarchy, into a apocalypse, a jihadist apocalypse, destabilizing everything we know and hold dear. But there are those who arise, and I thank you for speaking that there are those who arise and defend the defenseless in the defense force. There are those who stand and when the wolf comes and snatches the lamb from the fold, there are some shepherds, good shepherds, who will arise and, you know, even go into the lair of the wolf. Some call it the Hamas tunnel, and rescue the lambs. And that's what we're seeing in this time. And I could go on and on about my military service. I even want to write a book about that. And it's been consecutively almost 700 days at the time of this filming that I've been deployed. Consecutive deployment. I get some minor refresher breaks for a day or two, but it's been a consecutive deployment. And that's dealing with the tunnel threat. I'm with the Yahalom, which is like SWAT. It's like an acronym. Combat Engineer Corps Elite Unit for Special Missions. And we deal with the tunnel threat. There was no tunnel unit. I was the first one to, me and my guys were, they started this tunnel unit. It's become very famous all on the news, and called Samur, part of Yahalom, the Yahalom family. And our symbol, it's what we do. You know, you can check it out. I mean, endless missions throughout this time. In the tunnels, yeah, robots, ropes, you name it, every kind of technology, sensors, you know, since the beginning, actually, are established in 1948. But just to jump into and give you a little update, you
know, I'm sorry, the tunnel unit was established in 1948. They were already digging tunnels.
No, it was we were originally called it's the family of Yahalom.
Got
Yahalom. So in 1948, it was more just removing the explosives. It was Silup Tzatzot, EOD, Explosives Ordnance Disposal. And that was, there was a lot of explosives in the War of Independence. Yeah, explosives. After that, you have the development of Ya'el and the Sayeret. Go into the whole history of our unit and how you have development of underwater tactics for bombs underwater, for bombs on planes, for explosives and hostage situations that you have, like Entebbe raid, and so many different things. And then you have this development of the need to put a concerted effort to handle and dismantle and map under high stakes hostage rescue to destroy this, to be an underground commando. And that's what I am. And so I'd love to go on and on and share and one day write a book about indeed the heroism that's happened in this war after October 7th. October 7th and on. I mean, you could talk about people jumping on a grenade in former wars, even, you know, that I was in Le Second Lebanon War, and taking the blast so that the fr his friends and fellow soldiers lived. You could go into stories in this war, how people gave unspeakable bravery, and most of them were honored after they died. Running out of bullets in every kind of situation just to save one more life. But I like to just say that now it's, you know, Operation Swords of Iron. So Swords of Iron has been continuing. Now we're, I believe we're 600 at the time, and it's exactly 685 days, going on 700 days, which is almost 2 years consecutive deployment. And people are tired. People are going through it. Families are struggling, marriages are struggling, parents and children relationship is strained. Finances, of course, are very strained. The country's feeling the taxes and trying to fund this righteous war of self-defense to rescue our brothers and sisters, our sons, our daughters from the hand of torture and terror. So what it is that we just had an ambush. You know, I was just in Gaza just now, my uniform, Sergeant Major uniform. Special Operations Engineering Unit. So we were just in there, and there's this place called the Morag Corridor. So Morag is named after one of those cities, Jewish cities that used to exist in Gaza. There were some Jewish villages, small towns in the Katif cluster. And so what we have, though, is we have this issue where they're either emboldened because the Hamas are either the enemies, Islamic Jihad, Izzaldin al-Qassam, the al-Qassam brigades, our enemies, are either emboldened because of some Western countries, which I won't name, that they have been duped and fell to some propaganda. Because war is not just on the battlefield. The first casualty of war, everyone knows, is the truth. In wars, the first casualty is the truth. And people have been, they've been pushing so much propaganda out, and there's a lot of people to back these lies and to parrot. It's called the parrot Hamas lies and talking points. And so some Western countries have been duped to the extent of threatening to reward terror with a Palestinian state in September coming up very, very soon. So they're either emboldened because of that, or maybe they're desperate. Maybe they see that victory, full victory for Israel is around the corner, and they are getting emboldened. So just to update you briefly from just now, what I'm going through is there was an ambush. You probably heard about it. Around 20 Hamas well-trained fighters with RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, anti-tank rounds, missiles, guns, Kalashnikovs, all kind of very trained fighters decided to go into a base. You know, almost like how they went into Nachal Oz, how they went into Be'eri, how they went into Erez Crossing, how they took over Re'im base. People forget that multiple army bases were taken over Zikim, that were these places were taken over by terrorists. And of course, lots of kibbutzes, but bases as well. And so what happens is they went in there, but it just so happened, you could call it a miracle or just call it a, like it just happened, I don't know, that one soldier was able to see them just as they were doing their surprise ambush attack around 9 a.m. And a gun battle and a battle went on. And he was able to alert everybody else. And so the soldiers acted quickly, professionally. I'm glad for this because it could, and they were able to eliminate about half of those invaders. And the other half escaped into a tunnel that I was at, into a tunnel that I was, we hadn't blown it up yet. Somehow they connected to that tunnel, tvi, the tunnel length, and were able to initiate this attack. So you just gotta be vigilant. You gotta be, and we can't do everything at once. You know, things happen in stages. We just didn't blow that up yet. Who knew that they could use that, come from a different area, connect to that tunnel, and initiate an attack?
I think that one of the questions that most people, I think, have right now, of course, the hostages are first and foremost in our minds. And had it not been for the hostages, the tunnel system, I assume, could have just been destroyed. How do you know, or how can you ascertain that there is not a hostage in a tunnel before you detonate it or destroy it? How do you balance what needs to be done from, I keep hearing different things, but it sounds like only 10% of the tunnel system has been destroyed. Is it because you don't know if there are hostages in the other 90%? Is it because it's inaccessible? Like why is there that tremendous gap, and what precautions are taken to, obviously nothing can be ensured. War is chaotic, but to try to ensure that no hostages are hurt in the process.
Yeah. Again, some of the propaganda is that they, people see pictures of completely blown up buildings, and we have blown up a lot of buildings that were called staging grounds. Staging grounds means it could be used for a sniper. Maybe it was used, maybe it wasn't. Staging grounds for terror anywhere along the strip, anywhere along the border. We really leveled a lot of potential threats before they could be a threat. And definitely whether near tunnels or connected to tunnels, leveled them. But the propaganda is what people think is they see a building and they imagine a bomb hits it while they're all just having dinner as a family. That's not the case. We painstakingly took practically 2 years to carefully remove people, warn them, you know this, and they actually move. So the picture people see, it looks like, bam, we just went in there like maybe an American might do. Just boom, that's it. It's gone. Wipe it out. Nagasaki, you know, Hiroshima. No, we didn't do any of that. We carefully, nitpickingly, like Avodat Nemalim, it's called. It's like the work of ants to carefully move people over here, then clear the structure, clear the tunnel, send in their dog, send in the robot, send humans in as well. Yeah, and to be able to scour for it, are there hostages there? Are there tripwires? Oh, there's a blast door. How are we gonna remove that blast door? Do we have to use hydraulics? There's all kinds of, even to find it in the first place. It's an in-depth process. Then once you find it, how do you map it and clear it? Once you've mapped it and cleared it, how do you blow it up? It's a very drawn out and long process. Where does it go? Is there one level, two level, three level, four level? Where's the water plates? You know, you have water, seawater. How do you know when you're, there's a lot of calculations that you have to almost be a professional geologist and a engineer in order to understand. That's why we're combat engineers. Even though we're commandos, we are also, it's like a job almost as well. And then it's while under fire, while under attack, while in areas with tripwires and so on. So my point is you do all that scouring. It's not a quick, just blow it up and whoever dies, dies. No, it's like that. And I could explain it even at more length, which would take some time to unpack what we do. You could see how the robots work. There's things that aren't secret. There's things that are public knowledge to know how each of these, each of our, how our unit works. It's a book. You can see this is a
pretty cool book. Is this a book that people can purchase?
Yeah, people can purchase it. This isn't secret.
Okay, send me the link and I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure where to get it even, but I think it's on Amutati. Sorry, it would be on Amutati Alone. Mike, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
But yeah, that's just to get to answer your question in short, is it's a painstakingly, nitpickingly in-depth and involved process, which we've done. And that's why it's taking us, one of the reasons why it's taking so long, if we knew there were no hostages there, like Lebanon, like Hezbollah, right, controlled legally occupied territory by the terror group called Hezbollah, if that was the case, a lot quicker. You just go in and you don't have to worry. You assume everywhere, everything you see is hostile. Clear the people out and say everyone who's left is considered hostile. It's not like you're doing so much care for human life. I know that even in the West, people, the Westerners, they don't even understand tribes. And like, for example, the Navajo, the Cherokee, they have, this is our sacred lands, sacred lands. This is our burial customs of our people. Maybe First Nations, Indigenous, understand Jewish people, but the West does not understand it. They just say, hey, if I want to get hitched, I'll get hitched, I'll get married with in Vegas. Well, here, no, there's a custom of holding the tallit, and you have the holding of the, if someone dies, there's a honorable burial custom, you know, and so you can't just, oh, scatter my bones on the sea, who cares? No, we want each, just Joseph's bones in the Bible. You open up the Bible, Joseph says, bury my bones in the promised land. You know, what about Ben-Gurion? Bury me there at his life's dream, which is to make the desert bloom there in Mitzpe Ramon. So my point is they don't get that. And they also don't get sacred lands. We have sacred lands too. It's called Jerusalem, holy city. Even Tiberias is one of Judaism's, one of the four. But just to get into, if I could, quickly into some of these heroes, and I just thought it'd be great to take a moment. I know the war's not over, still continuing, but it would be great to take a moment and honor some of these heroes. Like you mentioned, this wonderful hero called Zamora. So Arnon Zamora. And so when he died, they changed the name of the entire operation to Operation Zamora. So what? Who was he? This was one of the missions, our missions to, again, high stakes hostage rescues, what it's called. One of the things we do as a unit. And so we connect with other units when we do this. And so it was June 2024, and Arnon Zamora, very Israeli sounding name, right, led a high stakes mission into the Nusirat refugee camp. Nusirat is a very tight, there's a few areas which are very, very tightly built because they were the original, back when there was only around 500,000, half a million refugees, which left because the Arabs said, we're going to kill every Jew in sight. We don't want you to be collateral damage. So the Arabs, primarily the Arabs asked all other Arabs to leave Akko. There was Arabs living in Tiberias. There was Arabs living in Jaffa. They were asked leave in 1948 before the war they started on us Holocaust survivors, you know, but people forget all this or twist it, and that's how they ended up there. And and so there's a few camps that are very, very tight, and we had intel that there was four hostages being held by Hamas.
And sorry, was this Israeli intel or was it Gaza intel? The reason I ask is because there's so much discussion about the people of Gaza were offered $5 million plus safe passage out of Gaza to give the information that allows for, this was later, of course, allow for the return of a hostage, and not a single person stepped forward. There's been extraordinary condemnation for good reason, asking who are the innocent civilians of Gaza. So did the intel come from someone who was captured? Somebody, people within Gaza who are actual Gazans, IDF, or can you even share that information?
I understood this specific case. It is a mix, just to answer you. There is a mix in general. This specific one, I think it was someone who was captured who gave up information. But you're absolutely right that offering them money, that's, again, the Western thought is, what do you want? What would you like? Would you like a Starbucks? you like another Starbucks? Would you like $50,000? Would you like, they're like, we don't want any of that. Would you like a Palestinian state next to Israel, next door to Israel? No, we don't want any of that, they'll say. Jihadism says we want to rule the globe and we want to kill anyone who's different than us, who's not a jihadist, must die. And then they'll end up, they'll kill each other too. That's how it is in the world of jihadism. You have Al-Qaeda isn't super duper friends with ISIS, and ISIS isn't super duper friends with the IRGC in Iran, and they're not super duper friends with, you know, Boko Haram, and they're not friends with Hamas, and Hamas isn't friends with Fatah, and it's various types of jihadism.
All you have to do is look at the number of civil wars are going on today across the Arab world to understand this Arab and Muslim, I should say. I'm sorry, I did not mean to interrupt. Let's get back to Arnon's story. Well,
to answer you though, is this one was from a captured, the intel was from a captured one, but there has been some, not for money, but there's been a couple, and I can't say their names or any of that, so don't ask me, that have given on their own. I only know of one. To be completely, there's one I know of, can't say his name, but one guy did a voice message which went to someone, which went to someone, which went to someone in another country, which went to the army, which said, there's a hostage in this house. And then, of course, he was killed. So I can't tell you which hostage and I can't tell you which guy, because he was killed, but his family wasn't all killed. But that's the thing. That's the price for when people say their name or when people, you know. And so you have this, you have it very rare, though. Mostly people are just very much brainwashed. I mean, that's what the brainwashed. So what happens is the Seeds of Summer operation, its name was changed to Operation Arnon. He ended up dying and being killed. But what happens is that four hostages were rescued. And so this man, his name is Arnon. And he lived in Sde David, near Sderot, right near the Gaza border. And he had a wife, Michal, two children, Nomi and Itai. And what happened is they went in, and what happened is as they went to this place, which was not in a tunnel, it was in a building, surprisingly, where these four hostages were being held, and they just, boom, lightning speed, just engaged in gun battles, and everything was actually working super well. And they were just like eliminating the terrorists, grabbed the hostages, put them in this specific transport, which wasn't very protected. And a bunch of bullets hit into the engine and hit into the stick shift. So the car got pinned and they weren't able to escape. And during this time, this is the short version, I could go a lot more into it, but during this time, they were trying to get the car to go. And then you have swarms of Gazans, of Hamas, of all kinds of people trying to kill them and block them, and their car wasn't able to get out. It's supposed to be in-out precision, you know? And those bullets in the stick shift was what, and then he tried to hold them off, and he was unwaveringly calm under fire, with deep compassion for his fellow soldiers, dedication to his family, and he stood in the gap, holding off the swarm, let's call it, the zombie swarm, let's call it, and gave his life. And so that brought four hostages home. And and so he protected his team, he protected his family, and he rescued these hostages. So I just think it's amazing to honor Arnon, Zamora, and there's many others that just don't get enough credit, because we're always just surviving. We're going just like by the skin of our teeth, they call it, getting through the day, just getting enough sleep to keep going, living on adrenaline and coffee. So caffeine and adrenaline, living that way for 2 years. Bombs from Iran, missiles from Yemen, tunnels from Lebanon, tunnels from Gaza, explosions and so on. And I thought it's so important to just take the moment in the midst of this and just honor another one. Second Lieutenant Avichal Reuven, paratrooper. And he, the cool thing about this guy is he just heard, this is on the 7th of October now, though. This isn't during the war. We could go on and on about heroes in the war. I was saying I could write a book about that. But this is people right on the 7th of October. He hears, it sounds like there's some sort of shooting happening in the south. What's going on? Hamas is invading. Doesn't really make sense. How can this be? Don't we have a fence? How would they possibly be taking over army bases and kibbutzes and killing and raping and literally, burning, beheading and burning and maiming and cutting off genitalia what is going on? And he just decides to, he had nothing. He just decides to, and he was an off-duty soldier, let's call it. So he decides to grab his uniform, which he had somewhere in his house, and just run. Because he knew the roads, you get on these roads, they block the road and they shoot. And that's how they were killing so many people that were coming. They just go behind a turn and, or like just over where you can't see over the bump, and they'd be over here and they just RPG the car and everyone dies. It's like an anti-tank round. And they just, so he ran about 8 miles. How many is that? Kilometers? I don't know, but about 8 miles into swarms, about 6,000 people, don't forget. Swarming from through this mob of some call them innocent civilians, but they were looting, pillaging, raping, killing, murdering, whether they were officially hired by the Hamas or not. So what was that? Did I hear something there? No. Okay. So what it is literally I'm realizing that he had such bravery that he just ran 8 miles straight into the front lines to protect his fellow Israelis. Extraordinary resolve, no transport. It's 12 kilometers is what it is. Under rocket fire, 6,000 invaders. And he just goes in, and he doesn't have that many bullets, but he joins in a chaotic firefight in the Zikim base. Zikim is on the beach.
Wait, how did he join a firefight without a gun? Or he had a gun, but no bullet. What?
Yeah, no, he ran. He did have a pistol. That's it, one pistol. And he just carrying his pistol, but he didn't have a proper rifle, you know, like that you're issued in the army. And so he engaged with a ton of different attackers. Some of them were coming in Zikim, they were coming by water. And a lot of those were young recruits that didn't have even a gun either. They were just in their basic training as they just joined the army, and they were scared. They were hiding. They didn't even have a gun anyway. They were hiding in a bomb shelter or something. And so he just took them on himself and saved a ton of lives. And he, you know, earned him national recognition, even a speech in the Congress of the United States about his bravery. So his name again is Second Lieutenant Avichal Reuven.
He survived this or did not survive this?
No, in the end, I believe that he died at the end of this. Yeah. Avichal did survive, but the next one that I'm going to share didn't survive. So he did survive in the end. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, when you say he took on this whole group of new recruits, what you mean, he just stood in front of them and defended them? He led them into battle?
They were hiding. So he just had to form a line and get whoever he could, jump in with whoever was with him. There was other people with him. And he just joined with them and held the line as long as they could. Many died, and he was treating the wounded at the very same time under fire and rescuing, being a wall of defense. He was also treating the wounded. There's other ones like that that were there as well that were treating wounded until they died themselves. And they just treated as many as they could, and then they themselves died, which you can go into that. But another one is Lieutenant Colonel Ben Yehuda, or Ben Yehuda. So that's also on the 7th of October. And her name, means light. And so she was with Caracal. Now, Caracal is women and men that served together. It was a big thing when it first was invented, women and men serving together. And so they had this issue. They were there on the 7th of October in the morning, and she heard that terrorists breached in through Sufa, because they came in through all kinds of areas, right? Sufa kibbutz. And so they breached there. She quickly mobilized all her girls, and they said, we're going to recapture an IDF base that they took over. We're going to recapture it. What bravery, you know? Again, 6,000 or so invaders just everywhere, and everything's on fire. Cars are burning. They put incendiary devices. What was that? Sorry. They put incendiary devices in the car, in the gas tank with a magnet, and it would burn the cars. So she decides, though, quickly to rally her girls and guys, and she commanded it on her own, just took command, and she, it was like a 4-hour gun battle, you know, against their, that was against the Nukba. So the Nukba are the highest trained, I mean, this is going to sound weird, but when you think of a Nukba trained fighter of the Hamas, it's almost like an elite commando. A lot of similarities to me. That's mm-hmm. the level that they are. I mean, they're trained really, really well. And they also carry with them, things that we don't carry. Because we have predators in the air, but they themselves carry RPGs and other incendiary devices and all kinds of other things and breaching tools that normally we don't carry. So they're in a way more trained, like to blow up the wall and go through the wall, things that push the whole fence away. They have these like rockets that are attached to the fence and it throws the fence. They had all this stuff that they invented. We don't have that kind of stuff. So she held them up at a 4-hour gun battle.
They're terrorist mercenaries. And I think that what people need to understand, because I don't think everyone understands that when you say it's weird to say that the Nukba forces, like to somebody who is unaware of what's going on, like they don't understand why is it important to even say the Nukba forces is different in any way. And the reason is because they're not a legitimate military. They are a terrorist organization that happens to be trained in guerrilla military techniques in a way that we've never seen in the world before, because it's a battlefield that's never been seen in the world before.
And with the amount of tunnels, like you have all these heroes in American military who fought in, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, and there's very many things, but the amount of tunnels, even Vietnam, there was tunnels, but the mm-hmm. amount of tunnels we've never seen anywhere, not in the thickest fight in the entire Afghanistan with and there was tunnels and they had hideaways and stuff, but nothing like this. This is something that Israel's facing, which the world can learn from how we've done it. I wish we did it faster and more decisive, but we're also at the behest often of other countries and also at the behest of keeping the hostages alive. So there was a convoy of literally 50 armed Hamas fighters, and she coordinated the use of anti-armor weapons tactics, inventing and being innovative in the midst of what could be the most strenuous time, because people have a freeze or fight, you know, fight or flight. So some people
fight or flee or freeze.
So some people, and so she didn't do, and she fought and invented fighting techniques. Her name is Oh. She's shown a light for Israel, for the Jewish people, by her bravery. She's like Deborah in the Bible, you know, modern Deborah. And people aren't talking about this because we're rushing, just like, hey, I got through another day today. I got through another day. But I just felt, man, let's talk about some of these heroes and remember them. Don't let them be forgotten, because, you know. And so she eliminated about 100, this girl, about 100 terrorists.
Herself.
Her and her other, and her girls.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. And thwarted them from getting into civilian communities, protected multiple towns. And these lionesses, watch out, you know, watch out. They're lionesses.
There are a lot of reports that more and more women are going to be joining the front lines simply due to the fact that, I mean, people, I don't even know if you could answer this. How many people other than you have been in service for the whole almost 700 days of the war?
So I don't know the answer to that, but I meet some of them. Some of them are with me, but it's, I don't know, because a lot of people have had time where they rest more and recharge, and maybe they go see a psychologist or psychiatrist, and they are trying to process. But in a way, though, I'm glad that me and some other guys that I know haven't had that. I'm glad, because you don't want to say, all right, let's take time to heal until there's time to heal. You don't want to say, all right, let's let the emotions out and talk about it when there's no time to talk about it. You don't want to say things that are not real. When this war is over, I'll have a lot of time, I believe, that I'll be able to process some of these things and maybe write a book. I don't know. But so yeah. Sergeant Eden Levy, she mm-hmm. amazing as well. Sergeant Eden Levy is another girl. So she defended Bad 4. Bad 4 is a training base. She defended it, and it was near Zakim, and they would have taken it too, just like they killed so many people in Zakim. They would have massacred everyone in Bad 4, just like they massacred the entire Ra'im army base. They came in there and just, I mean, and you had a few Bedouins that were fighting them, that were Bedouin soldiers, Arab soldiers. See, no one talks about this in the propaganda. Arab soldiers fought off Hamas in the Ra'im base. Arab soldiers fought Hamas. Arab soldiers. Because there's this weird thing like, well, I guess there's just everything's black and white and there's two sides here. And if we side with Hamas, well, we're siding with all Arabs everywhere and all Arabs. No, Arabs don't like Hamas. Arabs hate barbarism. Terrorists like terrorists, you know. So anyway, so she was at a different base, not Ra'im, and she wasn't an Arab. She's a Jewish, young 19-year-old Jewish girl, 19 years old. And the other one was 28. And she goes and is defending the Ra'im training base. And the Hamas came in by sea. And her name again is Eden Alon Levy. Her colleagues went there. And so she just had to shield, like the other dude I talked about, had to shield against shipfuls, way outnumbered Hamas gunmen. Okay. And so they battled them for hours and hours. And that's another thing, which I'm not going into now. Why did it take so long for people, myself included? Why, when I went there, why wasn't I immediately sent there to go help her? I mean, I was out here on the 7th of October, but I wasn't, the army wasn't like, here's where you need to go. We see what's going on the map. Go here, go here, go here. I wasn't, I'm like myself driving around. Like I'm one of these people driving around while they're burning stuff and seeing bodies. And I'm just going on my own because I wasn't getting orders. That's what I'm talking about. My whole story now. But
everybody, it sounds like everybody just sort of went wherever they could or thought that it was total chaos. Everyone I'm talking to, it wasn't right. Really command. Let me get to you, Clay, really quickly, and let's get back. On October 7th, you just went somewhere and said, I think I'm needed here. I'll stay.
Again, I don't want to go into my whole story now because that's a whole story, which I want to give it due diligence. But I was waiting for even to the gun. I have a pistol, you know, I have a machine, but I didn't even have that pistol then, actually. I didn't even have it then. I got it after. And wasn't issued my gun. I didn't have the key to the locker with everything, wasn't ready, didn't have a even uniform. Now some people had it in their basement, you know, musty uniform, and they threw it on, but they weren't issued like, here you go, you're going over here, you, you're now a team. None of that. It was just a bunch of haphazard craziness, and I got fed up and I just went into the midst of the battle, just like this, just like them, and into the midst of it to the Ra'im. I ended up in the Ra'im and saw so many bodies, and we were, yeah, so much. The sky was filled with black smoke, missiles, explosions, roads blocked. You can't even go in a road. They're blocked. Why is it blocked? Well, we don't know. Nobody knows anything. Who's alive? Who's dead? Nobody knows anything. It was just huge, huge debacle. But again, back to this heroic woman, Eden. So she goes and just gets the few people she has to defend this another base like Zakim. And she goes there and battles them for hours with only a few, I think it was 10 other people, way outnumbered. And so she saved about 90 young recruits that had no weapons either. They were just, you know, when you first get in the army, you don't have a gun. You just get a uniform and they're like, okay, we're going to teach you everything. And so, you know, that she made it that base never fell to the enemy. Because of this girl, that whole base did not fall to the enemy. And, but like I said, unlike the first person who did make it out, she didn't make it out. There was 7 IDF people who died there at the entrance of that base. And she was among them, her and her two friends, close friends. And so 3 out of the 7 were her people. And their selfless action just ensured that the base would stay under Israeli control and that everyone wasn't massacred. I walked through the base Erez crossing, and I saw where people were beat to death with clubs, women that were just there, women beat to death. Others were just killed. There's the barracks there, burned alive. People, I walked through there. In fact, the very flip-flops that I wear to this day, my flip-flops are from there. It was one of the soldiers, and I was like, you know, it was all burnt, and that somehow these flip-flops were still, and they were killed. But I just thought, you know, when I wear these flip-flops, I'm going to remember, I don't even know whose it was, one of those dead people. I'm going to remember their the fact that they stood and gave everything to defend this country. And those are the flip-flops I wear today, till this day. Yeah.
Do you think that the soldiers like you, I know you're a reservist, who sort of witnessed the worst of 10/7, who got there in time and saw the bodies and the atrocities and all the things, are faring differently on the battlefield than those who may not have seen the worst of the carnage? Meaning, I would imagine it gives you a different meaning to what you're doing when maybe these visuals repeat in your mind or remind you why are we here?
Yeah, I would say for sure. I would say 100% for sure these American Jews or Americans, Westerners, don't seem to have, whenever you talk with them, they don't seem to have a bearing. In fact, even worse, I don't want to be a dividing factor in any way, but even worse, there are some who speak against this righteous war of self-defense. And they are like, well, who needs Israel anyway? And, you know, it names some names, but I'm not gonna. And they're Jewish. And you say, you mean you don't get it? You just don't get it. I mean, it's, you can't make someone understand what they don't understand. People don't be like, listen, do I have, my friend told me this. He said, listen, Chaim, you speak out. You're on podcasts. You're speaking out on behalf of Israel. But don't you know that no one's gonna listen to you? Don't you understand that until Europe, till in Norway, in Iceland, in wherever, in downtown Philadelphia, a jihadist terror attack, this level, almost like the Twin Towers, happens, well, it's really like 30 times. You do a ratio of size of country to amount of people killed, it's 30 times the Twin Towers. So if you he says, you got to know, until the terror comes to their door, they're not going to get it. They're going to say, well, maybe it's about this or that, or maybe it's about money. They're trying to scratch their head. Maybe it's about they want more, a better American style life. No, that's not why. And that's the real core of it. I'm just going to get right to the core of it.
My actual question, though, Chaim, is in the soldiers. Like, you have new recruits versus people who were there on 10/7 and saw what happened. Do you see a difference in morale, in fatigue, in mission, in drive, in faith, and or does there's a lot of?
I was shocked with how good the younger soldiers, whether or not they were there, I kind of had this, let's call it a pessimistic approach. And I thought, you know, the heroes that founded Israel was one generation that lived through, you know, the War of Independence, the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, these grisly, wiry, ornery pioneers, loud pioneers who just do or die, they're do or die. But I thought, you know, people that have been raised in a peacetime and they raised with playing video games, watching movies, that's kind of a different generation. I don't know how well they're going to fare, you know, and I was shocked how well they fared, how brave they are still 22 years old. And then actually it taught me, everyone I'm talking about is like in their 20s, pretty much. Those people that we often take for granted, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, whatever. We sometimes say, yeah, these very people defended entire army bases against 6,000 terrorists. You know, like Lieutenant Ed Nimri. Amazing. And so you think of that and you think, wow, whether or not they saw that, they made a choice to stand for Israel. And I'm shocked how good they are. So I don't have enough evidence to really answer it. I just can say I've seen across the board heroes arise to make me want to do this podcast with you and just people know there's heroes out here. And Israel's getting this bad rap in the nations when they should be saying, we salute the patriots. We salute the heroes, not just on the 7th, but even till today. And they should be making, they should, you know, it's quite the opposite of what they're saying.
Yeah, please keep going. I let's hear some of the more of the heroes, not just of 10/7, but of the war and what I just, yeah.
Yeah, 22-year-old all-female Skywriters drone unit. So Eden Nimri, she took these drones. And she was, they're trying to fly these drones and stuff and trying to figure out what's going on. And she just says, I'm going to go for it. She grabbed a bunch of soldiers, this girl, awoke at dawn and ran into the area where she could see swarms of terrorists were coming in. Wave after wave. She was in her pajamas. This is just to show she never even got her uniform on. She's just in her pajamas. And what she did is she saw how many enemy was on their way to kill everybody. So she just blocked the door. Up with like boards and chairs and stuff. And in her pajamas, she stuck a gun out and she said, stay behind me, go to the second entrance. And she started they threw grenade after grenade on her and she would just kick it away or something. They're on her own. This lady was on her own. She's supposed to be flying a drone. All she knows how to do is fly a drone. She's not like this commando girl. She's a drone pilot, you know, like a kid flies a drone. Mm-hmm. And so she's drawing all the attackers to attack her. And she got everyone else out and stayed on her own there to like draw everyone onto her, thousands of terrorists. And so it distracted them because they were just trying to kill her so bad for like a long, long time that everyone else got to escape. All her girls got to escape and she saved. She took the brunt of the assault and the other soldiers were able to escape. And so she's remembered. After finally the last grenade, she was getting rid of these grenades that were thrown, but the last one she wasn't able to get rid of and she died. But she's everyone's hero. And so, you know, I'll just quickly tell a story really quick. Just even though this isn't from right now, but this is a war hero story is. So a friend of mine, Yosef Haddad, he's an Arab. He's an Arab soldier, very known, and he speaks on behalf of Israel. But what happened is when he was growing up in the Galilee here, and so his friends told him, they said, look, I know you love Israel and you're very patriotic, but the Jews are just going to use you. I'm saying the Jews, but it's you and me. But the Jews are just going to use you, and when they're done with you, they'll throw you out in the trash. That was very hurtful for him. But he thought, you know what? I'm still going to go into the army, even though they said I don't have to, because there can be sensitivities with Arabs in the army. And so they said, you don't have to join the army if you don't. He said, I want to. I want to go into the Golani unit, and I want to fight alongside my friends. So they sent him into the Lebanon War with me, second Lebanon War, 2006. And he's in, not next to me, but same war. And eventually what happens is a grenade is thrown on them by the Hezbollah. And his commander, Jewish commander, sees what's going on, jumps on the grenade. I don't know if this is a very famous story, and takes all the blast, saving him. But that wasn't the end of the story. Suddenly an RPG, rocket propelled grenade, is shot through the window and blows his leg off. It's hanging by tendons and lots of blood, and he can't walk. And he's just paralyzed. The boom is so strong, he goes flying, and he's paralyzed, but he can still hear and see. Really quick, what happens is his friends look at him and he can hear them. Now, did they say, this Arab is done. Let's just kick this Arab to the curb or whatever. They said, rescue him, save his life. Quick, quick, quick. Wrap him up, wrap his wounds. And so that's what they did. They wrapped his wounds and then suddenly he can hear them talking to the helicopter. And the helicopter, they said, there's RPGs, there's missiles. It's very hot. I don't know if we can rescue this guy. They didn't say it's an Arab, it's a Jew. They said, you will come and rescue our teammate that we love. And so that Jewish helicopter, one Jewish guy gave his life. The next Jewish helicopter pilots risked their lives, and then all his team carried them on their on carried him on their back on the stretcher under more gunfire, more getting injured to rescue this Arab and take him to safety. Finally, his life is saved, and he says, if anyone dares to bleeping bleep bleep talk about my country, that it's an apartheid bleep bleep bleep, I will bleep bleep you. He's very, I censored myself. But this is
I got that. I didn't think he said a lot of bleep. It is remarkable though, because to this day, Yosef Haddad is very, very vocal on social media. He also was at the Oxford debates that garnered millions of views. And yet people still look at him and say, no, I know better. You know, the smug, social justice warriors who are like, no, you're not telling the truth. You who experienced it do not know the truth. I know better from my couch in, you know, whatever, Massachusetts, that I'm going to tell you, you live in an apartheid state. And the ludicrousy.
Yeah.
Beyond.
A rabbi friend of mine, I don't want to say his name, but I have a lot of friends that are rabbis. And one of my good friends said, do you realize that there's blood libels from Middle Ages that still carry on to this day? And I was like, I guess I've heard of some. Which one do you mean? What do you mean? Like we poison the wells? What is it? And he's like, no, it's the Jew, the lying Jew, the lying Jew. You can't believe the lying Jew. And I thought about this. I was like, do people think that? He said, well, look at the YouTube. Some guy who's never been to Israel ever, not an archaeologist, not a Jew, not nothing, never been to Israel, that everyone will believe him. And he's like, you know what? I think the Temple Mount or the Dome of the Rock is, I think there never was a temple there. Wow. Breaking news. Why don't you ask any Israeli archaeologist, ask an Arab, ask anyone, but you don't want to believe the Jews. You'll believe some random guy that's nothing. And instead of the Jewish person, because there is this libel out there. People got to recognize some of the Middle Ages stuff is still here today. Unbelievable.
Well, they name another war where the West took the side of the terrorists instead of the democracy. And that's everything that we need to know. The fact that 97%, I'm not making up the statistic, Andrew Fox, my partner on the Paratrooper and a Yogi podcast, did the study. 97% of all mass media reporting is based on Hamas information. It is impossible to imagine after 9/11 if the New York Times said, you know what we're going to use as our source? No, not the U.S. State Department. We want to know what Al-Qaeda has to say about this. Like, it would never happen. The libels are tremendous. And by the way, on the note of libels, I just have to say this. Did you see the short by... Mark, he used to be a spokesperson for the prime minister about the sharks. It's a good one. Oh,
just that we trained the sharks to, or something. I don't know.
Yes, but he goes on about the turtles and the snails and the ants. And, you know, when you see sharks walking around the streets of Iran, you'll know that they're Mossad. And it's pretty funny.
I saw the one about Mossad agents breathe deeply and they took away the clouds, and it's highly trained operation. Breathe deeply, and then that's why there's water issues in Iran, because of the Jews. And it's like, sounds so insane, but I was like, someone could actually believe this kind of stuff.
It's unbelievable. I can tell you, as a yoga instructor, a Jewish yoga instructor, you know, breathing is a big part, pranayama, of my practice, and mostly what I'm working on is sucking clouds. So I and the Mossad pays me, which is awesome. But, you know, it works. I'm here to vouch for that one.
Yeah. So maybe one more. There's so many, though, that we can talk about. And then, of course, so many during the actual that are memorialized now who, you know, ran out of bullets just till the last bullet on a rooftop in the Ra'im base. I mean, there's so many to talk about. But let's just, again, we're still on the 7th of October, though. So Noam Bonfield was a young special forces reservist like me, special forces. And as soon as the invasion happened, he ensured that his own kibbutz Sa'ad was safe. So Saad is down there in the south, and he went to the next door, Kfar Aza. Kfar Aza is one of the ones that was hit the worst. I took even officials from Washington, D.C. through there, and had the honor of doing that. And so he was heavily outnumbered, and they infiltrated the community. They were burning a lot of cars, a lot of people. And he raced into the danger. When he saw there's danger, he just went straight at it. He didn't turn left, not right, not hid behind a tree, straight at it, and determined to protect his neighbors, his friends. And then he totally knew. He saw videos already circulating of hundreds of terrorists. Did that make him wince? Did that make him hesitate for a second? No. He grabbed together any guns he could find, any ammunition he could find out of people's houses. Give me what you have. And again, that's what I was just saying. He battled hundreds of terrorists, him and like five other guys, battling hundreds of. This is like Alamo. This is like, this should be memorialized. These heroes need to be commemorated. They can't be saying the wrong thing. These guys held off bloodthirsty, animalistic, apocalyptic zombies. And he held them off till he finally ran out of bullets. And he stalled the massacre. He saved countless lives because they were able to get to hiding, and he held them off because he acted so quick that he stopped them. Because when there's gunfire, you got to stop and deal with the gunfire if they're trying to advance. But if there was no, a lot of places there was none, and they went really, really far. They almost went on to Beersheba, almost went on to Tel Aviv. And so he held them off, and so his heroism was instrumental in forming a new crack unit. It's like a crack response. What do they call that? Speed response to just get some bullets happening back at them quick, before you set everything else up. That's what's needed. He did that on his own. And so there's a lot of stories, and I've been able to interview on my podcast, The Real Israel Podcast, which I'm hoping it'll grow quicker. And so I've interviewed family of hostages. Maybe one last one. One last one about just a
Give
family.
as many as you want. Yeah.
So Noam T-Bone is a family. Noam T-Bone was he's a retired major general, but he's a grandpa. He's a grandpa. He's sipping his tea on October 7th in the morning. It's Shabbat. Don't forget, it's Shabbat. There, it's Simchat Torah, rolling the scroll back. It's the end of Tabernacles, Sukkot, the eighth day, Shmini Atzeret. And so suddenly he gets a little call from his son and says, "Hey, I'm in Nachal Oz and I'm trapped. That's it. I'm trapped. I'm in Nachal Oz." So this guy, he's a grandpa, him and his wife Gali, and they said, "We're hitting this up." They knew the danger. They knew the danger, and they are so brave. They grabbed the pistol, grabbed, they had one pistol, jumped up in Tel Aviv. They left Tel Aviv. What would you do? You got to ask, because I lived through this,
Yeah.
and ask yourself, what would you yourself do? People watching this, what would you do? Would you do this? And so, grandparents to the rescue. He just says, "I'm a major general. I used to be a major general." All he's got is a pistol, and he drove through the besieged kibbutz, going off road, going through fences, just driving through crazy directions. And of course, authorities tried to stop him. They were like, "The road's blocked. Turn around. You're not allowed to go through here." And he's like, "I got to get my son. My son told me that I'm a soldier, and I'm going for it." And so then, as he's trying to get his son, people said, "I need to get out of here. They shot my leg. I'm bleeding to death. Get me out of here." He's like, "Okay." It's like Forrest Gump. "Okay, I'll take you to safety." So he takes one person to safety. He's like, "I gotta get my son." And then, "No, help me. I need to get out of here. There's no way And he's out in the fields. "All right, let's go." He takes another family and another civilians, and more and more and more, and so many, and taking them to the hospital. And the son is still there waiting. And he's like, "I won't give up. I'm gonna, even if it's night, I'm gonna get to my son." So he tries to get a bunch of people to join him, and he goes in close combat, house to house, looking for his son. Bah, 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 bah. Da, 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 da. Grenades. He finally gets to the house where his son is holed up, still alive, and he gets his daughter-in-law that his son married, and takes them to safety. And so grandpa and grandma save their son, and they all lived through it, and they all survived, and they inspire us all. Whatever age we are, you do what you can. I remember what it was in after 9/11, and here's the thing is, people watching this, I've never heard anyone, people have talked about everything, but I've never heard anyone really ask or answer the question of why. Because it's very hard. It's very hard emotionally. It's very hard. It's the very Pandora's box, the very fabric of our existence. If you ask the question, why? Why did the Twin Towers get bombed? Why was America so mean? Because this is the West has this foolishness, this cause effect. They got it wrong. Why did the Twin Towers get bombed? Why did those terrorists, and I'm not talking conspiracies, why did these terrorists kill 3,000 people plus? Why? Indoctrination. It's because they believe they can usher in a new Sharia existence and defeat the West. And they would gather all their people together and they would inspire, that bloodbath would inspire others to do bloodbaths, and they would essentially destroy what's called the very foundation that the West is founded on, the biblical foundation. And so then you ask yourself, why? What, you know, he's a wealthy guy, Osama bin Laden. Why did October 7th happen? Did they meet some Jews mean to the Hamas? We were giving them, I mean, I hate to say this, we even gave them weapons. It's known. Israel even gave them weapons, gave them jobs, electricity, water. People would come. They didn't say, are you Hamas or you're not Hamas? You can just come in and work in Israel. Hamas were working in Israel. Why did they do the October 7th? They never met a Jew, except if they came to work, and all those were peaceniks. You know, they're like hippies that just were all about, let's do peace. Let's do soccer and joint soccer initiatives with Gazans and Jews. They, you know, why did October 7th happen? Nobody's really asked it and nobody's really answered. It's because of indoctrination. If people can get that Mein Kampf was translated in Arabic, this is why, because of Hitler's book in Arabic and because of a jihadist teaching, that's why. Not because they didn't have a nice life there. Not because of anything. It's because of teaching hate. Why did the Holocaust happen? There's an even deeper, I don't mean what can we learn. I don't mean what can we, the Jewish people, learn. I mean, why did they do it? This is a scary thought. What was the real reason? No one's asking it and no one's answering it. Because the reason why I'm saying that, if we'll ask it and if we'll answer it, we can hopefully not repeat it. But if we don't ask it, we don't ever answer it, it'll repeat. October 7th could repeat if that indoctrination continues, is allowed to continue in America. The very same teaching, just find what were they teaching, and if that exists, October 7th could exist in America, in Canada, in England, in France, in Belgium, wherever. That's the scary thing, and I could go on and on, but these heroes stood up in the time of great, great evil and continue to stand. And I have the actual greatest privilege of my life. I know I'm going to make it through this war alive. I know I will. But I'll get to say, I've had the greatest privilege of my life to meet and to serve alongside people who've given up everything. Restaurants, businesses, trips, relationships, everything. Hiking up Machu Picchu, all kinds of stuff. Gave everything, including their own finances, to do what's right. May more people around the world stand up and do what's right in this time.
Amen. Listen, beyond your military service, I do want to reiterate to everyone that Chaim has the Real Israel podcast. The link is in the description below. He is also the chairman of the board of the Aliyah Return Center, which I already mentioned. Chaim, you also have an Israel and the Nations immersive course. You're the chairman of the board of the Faithful Galileans. You write about Israel. You sing about Israel. What is it about Israel? What about Israel inspired you to dedicate your entire life to honoring your nation like this?
I never was one that wanted to hold a pistol or to have a gun. It's not me. I'm not. I'm more of a farmer type. I was raised on a farm. We're not really that kind of. It's just when I realized that there's a great need. You come to a place you don't know what to expect, and you realize. You still need pioneers. You can think Oregon Trail. think Wild Wild West. It's Wild Wild East. Still today, it's gunslinging Wild Wild East, and you've still got, you still have, what is it, Babyface? You still have Wyatt Earp, and you still have you know, Jim Crockett, Davy Crockett, and you still have, you have those people here, and we need everybody. I mean, when one person leaves Israel, one Jew leaves Israel, people say, man, Israel's going to miss you. Israel needs you. Israel needs you. Your country needs you. That need, and also you add to that, that this is the only country in the world that it, that that Psalm says pray for its capital, Psalms 122. You know, David's like our prime minister, David, says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Those that love you will prosper. You know, it's like the only country in the world that has, is going place, is going somewhere. Yeah, the temple's going to be rebuilt. Yeah, whether people like that or not, I know this, people might not like that idea, but it's there in Ezekiel. It's going to happen. So it's in our writings. So it's an adventure. And I am, if I'm anything, I'm an adventurer. And I live to, and I think that it's important for all of us to know, what are we destined for? We're not destined. We are not destined for just to have a good life. That is not any historical figures. That's nice to have, but we are born into a world, and we are destined to do something in that world. Whatever it is our destiny. And I found mine, and that is to be a shepherd of Israel in the army and in any way I can to help.
Thank you so much, Chaim. Before we end, I just want to add my tremendous gratitude, honestly, to you. You are an absolute hero of Am Yisrael. One doesn't have to literally give his or her life to be a hero, because you've given your life completely while continuing every single day in this war. Your extraordinary dedication and bravery, it just can't be understated. And I personally salute you for your selfless service, and thank you for everything you do for Am Yisrael, because Am Yisrael is not just the people who live in the country of Israel, but all Jews everywhere whose souls share a part of this nation. That includes me in Los Angeles. So thank you for fighting for me.
It's an honor, my greatest honor.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you want to add before we sign off?
Yeah, you know, there's always things that people can do. Like, I know that this sounds cliche, but in a world of lies where everyone, there's billions of other people that are siding with a certain narrative, there's very few who can share this. I know this sounds cliche. There's very few people who can share this podcast. Literally, make it your job to start sharing to groups things like this podcast, because you're needed. We need you. Israel needs you right now. And this is the time. The war isn't just on the battlefield. It's the media war. And we're losing it. So share this right now, please.
We need more voices. And thank you for the plug. Thank you again for joining me. Hopefully I will see you next time I'm in Eretz Yisrael in December and January. And until then, you know what they say in the old country. Am Yisrael Chai.
Yisrael Chai. We'll talk soon. Hey, thanks.
Okay. Bye.